Welcome to the Dharma Talk. Let's begin by sitting rather quietly and simply use the breath to soothe and calm one's emotional world. So if you're feeling as if there's a burden in the chest area or your heart is sore, then really just using the breath to calm the body and mind for a few minutes. So my theme tonight is the freeing of the mind. And some of you may have heard parts of this talk before. However, if we can understand what's actually being said, and I'm taking some of the text from the Honeyball Sutta, if we can understand what the Buddha is saying, and see into what's going on in our own heart and mind, then consciousness opens out. We start to relate to the world in a rather different way. So in many places, of course, around the world at the moment, including my own country, Australia, there's unspeakable violence that happens. We have a really huge problem with domestic violence in Australia and violence towards women. We also have a very difficult issue with the treatment of our Indigenous peoples and how over centuries, the last two, this has been happening. And so I'm not coming here to lecture you about this. It's a worldwide difficulty that we as human beings encounter. Our mind has the capacity for extraordinary cruelty, but also for peace, compassion, joy, and equanimity. And so the Dharma teachings are a training of the heart mind to the freedom itself. So some years ago, as I was reflecting on this issue, I asked myself, well, what does the Buddha say about it? What does he say about wars and violence and how we can live in a different way? And then I read the Honeyball Sutta, and it's called the Honeyball. In India, There's these really delicious sweets. They're called kekadums. And at the time of the Buddha, one could buy these sweets in Varanasi. There is still a shop that makes them. They're amazing. They're kind of milk sweets, and in the middle, they melt in your mouth. And at the end of this sutta, of the Buddha says, if we can understand this, it's as sweet as a honey ball. So let's see. Let's see if we can. The sutta is about thought proliferation. And it requires us to understand and see what thoughts we grasp to and the content of them and what that means for us. The word, the Pali, there's a Pali word for thought proliferation, and it's papancha. And there are several different types or themes or categories. So today you've probably had an enormous number of thoughts, thousands and thousands of them, and some will have been about yourself, some will have been about other people, some would have been based on identity, some would have been based on desire, and some would have been around views. The mind may have fixed on a particular view or idea or position. So part of our practice is understanding this movement of mind. We know we're thinking and what we're thinking because we're aware. So awareness reveals what's going on in the world of thought. The definition of papancha is this: it refers to the projection of mind that arises as a result of cognition and perception. So the cognition is the thought world, and perception is how we know things based on memory from the past. So I'm sitting here, if I open my eyes, I immediately know I'm in the meditation hall of Endor based on my past experience. And this is perception. The mind is really fast and quick. So if we really pay attention, just before we label everything and name it as Endor, meditation hall, what we see is just a mass of colors, really. But it takes some quietness of mind to really see this. And it's not all that important, actually. It's most important to realize that the way we perceive things is based on our conditioning from the past. And of course, we're invited to see this whole process of thinking as not me, not mine, not who I am. Ordinarily, the mind just grasps these particular types of thought and claims them as me, my view, myself, how I am, who I am, my desires, what I want, and so on. So we very quickly, it's a fairly automatic mechanism of mind, we grasp and cling. There's a saying that wherever there's perception, there's deception, so we don't see clearly. Yet, we can see clearly, and our practice, we practice and we sit and we reflect and we inquire in order to bring about a clarity of mind. So let's take a very famous part of the text. It goes like this: dependent upon the eye and forms, I, so EYE, we're talking about here, I consciousness arises. So there's the form, the I, and the I consciousness that sees. So the meeting of these three, the I consciousness, and the object, is contact. And immediately upon that contact, there's a feeling tone. I look at this bell and immediately I think, oh, I've got a beautiful bell at home from Japan that a musician friend bought me. And so the mind is off and running. I'm comparing this bell with the one I have at home, the sound of which I prefer, and so on. And so you see how quickly the mind goes into elaboration and story. It moves to the past and overlays the present experience. So with contact as a condition, there's feeling. What one feels, that one perceives. What one sees, that one thinks about. What one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. So in other words, what that means is we have one thought, we have another thought about that, and then even more thoughts about the thoughts, and before long we just have this looping mind in this circular pattern of thought. So this tangle of feeling, perception and thought affects us, or in the text it says it besets us, with respect to the past, present and future. So the mind roams through the fields of time. So the memory from the past impacts on the present. And then the mind projects to the future, and that too impacts on the present. Or, of course, we can equally be caught up in the present and cling and grasp to it. However, we are urged by the Buddha to see each presently arisen state, to really see what's going on for us in the heart and mind. So Papancha is the way we overlay the truth of things based on our capacity to roam through the fields of time and the mind to grasp at certain memories or impressions. So if we go to the past, we often regret something. If we go to the future, we are caught up in anxiety or uncertainty, and so on. So our conditioning, our background, shapes consciousness, and we actually rarely see with crystal clarity, but rather the mind that's conditioned is imposed upon the events that are occurring. The other thing that we do is we imbue certain objects with desirability. Objects, people, places, and things don't have desirability in and of themselves. That's our movement of mind. We desire. And so once we see this, it's extraordinary, because the movement of desire isn't in the outward person, place, thing, the mango we love to eat or whatever. The desire is here. And so this movement where we like or we dislike, tomorrow in the instructions we'll come to the feeling tone of experience. So every sight, sound, smell, taste, touch and thought has immediately a feeling tone, pleasant, unpleasant, or in between. And most of you are familiar with that. And of course, we generally we like the pleasant and we don't like the unpleasant, and we tend to ignore the in-between feelings. So we have to understand this movement of mind in an unfolding process that occurs for all of us. So we project desirability. And so knowing ourselves well is important, and seeing what the mind does opens up a way of being where the heart and mind can be rather free. And consciousness isn't simply thrown about depending upon our likes and dislikes, our attractions and aversions. Papancha also involves the way we think in dualistic terms. So we divide reality into the thinker and the thought, the knower and the known, the seer and the seen. And in that way, we're constructing the one to which life is happening. And this is an error, really. We don't quite understand what we're doing most of the time. So we have to understand that the self is constructed in this process when we construct the meditator, the person, the one who is experiencing life, the self, the I, the me, the mine. There's a wonderful monk called Vimalo Kulbag, and he's written quite an academic article. I love it. It's called Awakening to Truth. And he says that due to certain past associations, certain feelings and emotions arise regarding a sense impression. So, of course, out of all the sense impressions that we've had, there's only a few of them that really grab us and make an impact. So, coming back to the sutta, one has thoughts about that which one perceives. We have thoughts, plans, and ideas connected to a particular thing, what we want, a person, a place, and so on. Now, Vimalo says that due to these associations, so due to our conditioning from the past, that the thoughts are loaded with emotions. Don't we know this? So often these associations are really emotion-driven. We think that we're meeting life afresh, but we're actually meeting it based on fear, or based on our conditioning from the past, or we meet life based on our projections into the future, our anxieties, the uncertainty with which we face. We also meet life based on our views about ourselves. We might think, I'm inadequate, I'm not good enough, and so on. I'm unlovable, I'm unworthy, the kinds of things we hear. Or, I know best, I'm right. So, there are a number of types of papancha, and I've covered some of them already, but I'll just say them again. The first is around identity, so it's called mana, identity. And this involves usually comparison, being superior to, inferior to, or equal to. So as soon as we cling and identify with nationality, religion, with colour, with education, with social status, whatever, we're dividing reality, we're separating ourselves from our direct experience. So of course, wherever we cling, it's problematic. But when we identify and cling to a thought, we actually contribute to creating the self. The self idea becomes rather solidified or crystallized. So with the thinking, we actually form or bring together this whole notion of self. And then, of course, having the self, we then have the view about the self and how we think of ourselves. And that's problematic for most of us. And of course, the third type is the type of thoughts that are about craving, craving-based. Vimala suggests a couple of other types. One of them is the person who tends to see things rather negatively. So the mind often goes to the aversion, the fault-finding, the criticism. And so this can overlay reality and not make us see clearly. We don't see clearly. And another distortion, of course, occurs through thoughts that are laden with fears. So when we're very fearful and we have a series of fearful thoughts, it also distorts reality. So here I'm going to tell a story, just so that you see that it's can be applied. The wisdom from this sutta can be applied. And the first one, take off the glasses. The first one's about an incident that occurred in India in 2006. Like in many other places of the world, there are attacks and bombings. And in Varanasi on this particular day, there actually were three sites that were bombed: a railway station, a market, and one other place. I was particularly concerned because my daughter was actually there at the time. And luckily, some friends looked after her. But the third place where there was a bombing was actually in a temple, and it occurred during a wedding. And the Mahant of Varanasi, who's a priest, the high priest of Varanasi in the Hindu tradition, was there leading the wedding ceremony. And at the time, he was chanting. He's a friend, and he was a friend, and he's died in the 19—he died some years ago now. And I would stay with him when I was in Varanasi. And he told me about it, and he said, Radha, I have never seen such a thing in my life. And in that moment, he said, I did not know what to do. Then he said, a thought came, and he thought, okay, I will just continue chanting. I will continue the ceremony to calm people down and to try to add a sense of stability to the chaos that was happening. So the horror, you can imagine, I won't go into any details, but that night, of course, a huge crowd gathered outside the gate of the temple wanting retribution. And so Sonia Gandhi came. Mahanshi stood there, and a representative of the Muslim community. And they stood side by side together, and they faced the crowd. And they told them that violence and aggression and anger was not the way. And essentially they begged them to go home. They did. The next day, some Muslim musicians came to the temple, They came to the temple and they played Hindu songs as a gesture of peace. Extraordinary. And the whole city remained calm. When Mahanchi was telling me the story, he said, I said, thank you for keeping the peace for India. And he just said, Radha, what else would I do? So he was a man of extraordinary wisdom, a man who could see beyond his own religion, beyond his own culture. He could see the non-difference and the wisdom of peace. And he even came to the Buddhist temple in Saranac one day. Some friends of mine said, no, Radha, don't invite him. He won't come. He can't come. He's the Hindu priest. And I said, yes, of course he'll come. And he did. And he came and he spoke to us while we were on retreat. And he was full of love and wisdom and an extraordinary human being. He was not only a priest, but he was also a scientist, and he was head of the program to clean up the Ganges River. And friends of mine have been very involved in that over the years. Unfortunately, the river is still very polluted. But that was one of the things that he had set his heart on. And so it's our clinging to differences, our clinging to identity, our clinging to standpoints and views, and our clinging to desires that separates us and is the cause of all wars and violence. The Buddha says this, he says, if we can understand that we need to let go of clinging in these three particular areas and understand what this sutta is telling us, he says, this is the end of resorting to rods and weapons, of quarrels, brawls, disputes, recriminations, malicious words, false speech. Here, these unwholesome states cease without remainder. So now I'm going to tell another story. It's a lighter story, but it also happened about 20 years ago or so. In Australia, in Tasmania, Tasmania's the island off the south, you know, south of Melbourne, in the bottom of Australia. There's a lot of mining happens. And they were drilling and mining and blasting about a kilometre under the ground. I'm not sure exactly what they were mining, but anyway, the mine was very deep, and because they'd been blasting so much, some of the tunnels collapsed and most of the people escaped, but three people were missing. In a day or two later, one person's body was found, and the other two people were not found for 14 days. People were searching and doing really heroic rescues and trying to find them. What had happened is one of the men who were missing said that he was buried up to his neck in rock with the blast. And so he said there was incredible pressure on his chest, and called out. And then eventually one of the other miners came. And so there were the two of them. And the one who was trapped couldn't do anything. And so the other man took rocks one by one, but then he had to stack them because they only had this little tiny space, like 3 meters by 2 meters for the two of them. So they had to stack the rocks to keep the space. So they had space and air. They could only sit up. They couldn't stand. And there they were. And so they waited, hoping to be rescued. Days and days and days went by. Can you imagine the papancha? Can you imagine the thoughts that people were having, the two of them were having? Well, they were kind of typical Australian men whose conversation is usually about, I'm exaggerating here, but conversation is very often about cars, football, or some other kind of sport. They were two vastly different human beings. So there they were together. And they reported that they started to try to talk to one another. Now, one of them said to the other, "What kind of cars do you like?" And one said, "Oh, Fords are the best." And the other one said, "Oh, no, I'm a Holden man." So Holden used to be an Australian car. And so they just could not agree about the cars. Like, absolutely, they couldn't agree about the cars. They just were absolutely different. And then one said, trying to make some conversation, "Well, what do you like to do on the weekends?" And one said, "Oh, I like to go shooting." And the other one went, "I'm a vegetarian. I don't like to kill things." And so there they were, day after day, with someone with whom they could find no common ground. One said, "What sort of music do you like?" And one said, "Oh, I like heavy metal." And the other one said, "Oh, no, I only like folk music." And so on. And so there they were, focused on their differences and not finding any way of communicating with one another that was easy. Can you imagine that? You might be with the last person you ever see on the planet. You're 1 kilometer under the ground and you can't even make conversation. So there they were. So funny. And then, of course, after some days, they could hear the blasting that was taking place as people tried to, you know, discover them or find out where they were. And it became obvious to them that the people searching were looking for their bodies, not expecting them to be alive. And so there they were stuck. They said that the blasting went on for 9 days every 15 minutes. And every 15 minutes, they thought they were going to die because their little space started to fall down. And so can you imagine that? Unbelievable. And so as the rescuers became closer, they started shouting, "We're alive, we're alive, we're alive." And eventually somebody heard them. So then there was the task of making a hole through this very hard rock so that some things could be passed through. But there's I want to go back a little bit actually, because I missed a part of the story. While the blasting was taking place, because they thought they were going to die, they began to write goodbye letters. They had some pens in their pockets on their clothes and on their bodies. And so they wrote to the people they loved in their life. And then, of course, they read to one another what they'd written. And in that way, they came to meet one another. They came to understand one another. They came to care about one another. And when the blasts happened, they wrote the time and date so that their loved ones would know when exactly they died. So it was actually the care and the love that crossed the gap of the differences in views. So it's the love that liberates. You see, they had opposing views. Every view has an opposite. And it didn't matter what they tried to talk about. they had opposite views. Yet, when they talked about their families and those they loved, they could meet and care and be concerned for the other. So it's the love that frees the mind. It's the love that frees us up from our fixed positions and standpoints. And the good news is they were rescued. And once they could pass something through the little hole, the rescuer said, "Well, what would you like?" And one of them said, "A Saturday paper." And in Australia, this is really funny. They said, "Send me a Saturday paper." And the people rescuing were amazed. "Why would you want a Saturday paper?" And he said, "To look for a new job." And then they passed through some little yoga mats for them to put underneath them because they were very sore from lying on the rocks. And then they made more jokes. They said, "Oh, it's two star and we're the two stars." And so by this time, of course, the whole nation, all of Australia was watching this rescue because even then we didn't know whether they would survive or not, whether it was even possible to bring them to the surface. But luckily, yes, they both survived, which is extraordinary. So can you imagine being in that position and still clinging to identity, desire and view? Amazing. And now I want to speak about something else, a little bit different. Bhikkhu Bodhi has written some articles about what is happening here. And of course, he's a very famous translator of the middle-length discourses, as well as many other volumes of discourses. And he says this, he says, and this is about peace. He says, "To achieve real peace, we need a global commitment to protecting people everywhere from harm and misery. The commitment must be rooted in a universal perspective that enables us to see all people as our brothers and sisters, worthy of care and respect, regardless of their ethnic, national, and religious identity." So in other words, he's asking us to look beyond the difference and see the humanity of the other, to see the non-difference. And he goes on to say, he says, "The root of violence is in the mind. Therefore, in the tradition, what we're asked to do is to give a lot of attention to exploring and understanding the world of thought, because we give thought such power. Thought has the power to lead us to either wise action or unwise action, to violence or to peace." And he sets up, actually, some steps that we can actually take in order to have a wise response to the events that are happening in the world. And I mentioned them in the last retreat, but I'm going to mention them again. He said the first is a matter, he calls it internal hygiene, which I think is a funny name, but he says it's simply to pause, sit down, and process what we're going through. So instead of allowing our emotional world to overwhelm us and be caught up in anger and rage and negativity and fear as a response to the injustices of the world, instead of doing that, we really need to, first of all, pay attention to our own emotional world. And of course, we do this, as we heard earlier today, with tender loving care to the to the heart, the emotions. We see where we're grasping beliefs and ideas and positions, and we just rest until, he says, the bare bodily sensations yield to the innate radiance of the tranquil mind. So when we really pay attention, we see that the natural radiance of the heart-mind is tranquil and peaceful. So when we let go of our grasping these different areas, we start to rest into a very natural peace. So he says that's the first step. And then, of course, the next is to cultivate the heart and to expand that love and care to embrace all beings. And this is our metta practice. And the third part, he says, that once we've established love and compassion as the guardians of the heart, it's to find opportunities to express our moral convictions or to relieve the suffering of another. So it's to find ways, in small ways and big, to be compassionate, to act in a compassionate way. And the fourth step, he says, is discernment and reflection, to understand how we as human beings have gotten ourselves into this terrible predicament of war and division and anger and rage and retribution. And we're not only destroying one another. The Middle East is not the only place there's a war at the moment, obviously, but we're actually destroying the planet on which we live. And so we need to kind of stop and go, okay, what is it we can do, and what does the Dharma teach us about how to live with wisdom, how to live in this world, and how to respond in a wise, compassionate, and creative way that is not bound to the conditioning of the past. It's not bound to fixing upon any kind of identity or not caught up in desire, the kind of desire that the greed that's fuels the destruction of our planet, or to taking a particular view and being very fixed about that. And now I want to come to a statement by one of my teachers, Ajahn Buddhadasa. And it's about Nibbana, it's about freedom. He often referred to natural Nibbana, so the freedom that we could just know by just turning the heart and mind to the peace. And he said, Nibbana, the ultimate reality in Buddhism and goal of the practice, and the highest potential of humanity. Nibbana manifests when the fires of defilement, attachment, and selfishness of dukkha are cooled. When they are permanently cooled, Nibbana manifests perfectly, totally, timelessly. It's not a place. For Nibbana is beyond existence and non-existence. It's not even a state of mind, for Nibbana is neither mental nor physical, but a Dharma the mind can realize and experience. He says Nibbana is to be realized in this life. And so here I want to read a little from a meditator's account of a release to peace. This is from a book by my friend Guy Armstrong, and this is from a Western meditator, it doesn't say who. It was in the middle of a long retreat. I had been following the breath of the abdomen for 3 weeks. So a 3 week retreat with continuous noting. So he's doing the Burmese technique of noting in, out, touching. So I'd been doing this for 3 weeks. In one sitting, there was a deep sense of calm, followed by the grasping of that calm. And we know that. We have the moment of calm and then the mind clings. Immediately and without any effort on my part, the note arose grasping. I wondered with great curiosity, who knew that? Then there was an abrupt transition, a subtle vibration of unmoving peace stood out from the background. The foreground fell away. There were no mental formations, no consciousness of the body or physical senses, but some kind of awareness continued. Because perception wasn't operating, it's impossible to say what was being known. But some unshakable peace was revealed, which had been there all along, totally uncaused. So this is the natural freedom of heart that we can come to when we cease habitually clinging and grasping to identity, to desire, and to view, or thoughts that lead us in a particular direction. Now, it's not that all thought is problematic. Some thoughts lead to liberation and freedom, and we can see a thought with complete clarity. And a final good news story. This is one from Byron Bay, where I live. There's a surfing beach called The Pass. Some of you might have been there and know it. And, you know, it's a nice little cozy corner, and often beginner surfers learn there. And on this particular day, there were a husband and wife, and they were on a surf ski. So like it's like a board where you sit and you paddle. The woman was paddling, and she saw beneath her a dark shape. Yes, it was a shark. Before she could do anything, the shark bit the back of her paddleboard, threw her in the air, and there she was, face to face with a white pointer. These are the most deadly sharks that we have in Australia. At that moment, and I saw her interviewed immediately after this had happened, at that moment, she did not panic. Amazing. In fact, what happened was a memory came of a TV show she'd seen saying what to do if you're attacked by a shark. And so she did exactly what she'd been told. She hit the shark with her paddle. She shouted, she splashed, she screamed, she punched the shark. The shark left. True. Amazing. Her husband said, come back on my board. And she refused, got on her own board and paddled in. The only injury she had required 2 or 3 stitches in her wrist where one of the shark's teeth had cut her. Now, when she was asked, are you going surfing again? Guess what she said? She said, well, yes, of course. As soon as my stitches have healed. And she did. So this is fearlessness in the face of death, potential death, and absolute clarity of mind. Thought, unproblematic thought, this is what I have to do. And she just did it and lived to tell the story. I thought it was remarkable. And so we're not demonizing all thought. Thought in this case was exceedingly useful, saved her life, memory of what to do. So you're all invited to Australia. Now you know what to do. If there's a shark near you, make lots of noise and pretend you're really, really big. I'm hoping this doesn't happen to me. So, to summarize, the heart and mind knows extraordinary freedom. We can touch great places of love, compassion, feelings of ease and joy and profound peace. And the Buddha's teachings are teachings of non-harming, the teachings of peace, and the teachings of immense freedom. So please understand this whole process and mechanism of mind. Don't be caught up in the I thought or the desire or the view. And when we let go, there's something extraordinarily priceless on offer, freedom of the heart and mind. So thank you, each of you, for listening. Let's just sit together quietly. May all beings realize the wisdom of non-clinging. May all beings find release from pain and sorrow. And may all beings live with love and compassion.